It's the best book because it is full of treasure, God's treasure to us. So we've covered some of the early things in the Bible there, very briefly, but we covered some of the main early things. And we're going to hear a reading now from God's Word. So if you have a Bible, please turn to Hebrews chapter 11. If you've got a church Bible, it's page 1209. And Maria, thanks very much, is going to come and read about some of these early people in the Bible and written about much later in the Bible and their faith. Hebrews 11, 1-16. Thanks, Maria. Sorry.
Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for, an assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings, and by faith, Abel still speaks, even though he is dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken away, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that is in keeping with faith. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was enabled to bear children because she considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them.
And so, for a few weeks, the aim is to fly over the Bible, the whole thing, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, sometimes pausing for a while, so we get the flow of it and see God's big story. But in a sentence, what is the big story of the Bible? In a sentence, what is it? What is the Bible all about? Why don't you take a moment to ask the person next to you that question? If there's no one next to you, why don't you just think about it? What's the big story of the Bible? Ask the person next to you, please. Okay, let's have some answers. What do we think, roughly, is the big story of the Bible? Judy? Ah, the way of salvation, Jesus. Oh, that's taking everyone's answer, isn't it? Yeah, that'll do, isn't it? Yeah, God's plan of salvation through Jesus. God's rescue of sinful man through Jesus. And while you're chatting, we're chatting about, let's try these questions. We can't let all the children have all the fun, can we? Have a go with the person next to you, these questions, please, for a minute or so. Okay, let's go through quickly. First question, what's the longest book of the Bible? Psalms. Psalms. Yeah, so because more chapters. Yes, there's 150 chapters in Psalms. But And then second place is Isaiah. There's 66 chapters in Isaiah, so that's like a distant second, isn't it? But by word count, It's not Psalms. Sorry, a bit cheeky, isn't it? The longest book of the Bible by word count is... Genesis second. Jeremiah's the first, 33,000 words, roughly. Genesis, 32,000 words, then Psalms with 30,000. You just needed to know that, didn't you? You really. Okay, which is the only book of the Bible that doesn't contain the word God? Esther, isn't it? Yeah, it's the book of Esther. Of course, it's all about God and majorly about rescue. But Esther is the only book in the Bible that doesn't actually have God's name in it. Circumcision, getting slightly harder, is a sign of God's covenant with Abraham. Can you name any other covenants and their signs? And of course, this is where we're going today. Oh, we're going to have to do little kids' hands up thing, aren't we? Because yes. Yeah, the rainbow was the sign of the covenant with Noah. Yep, so the covenant with Noah, God's covenant, was signed by a rainbow. Any others? That's not officially a covenant, really. That's a picture, a new covenant. Oh, wow, right. So the cutting of the animals and the fire going through. Yeah, okay, so that's a covenant with Abraham. Yeah, and the sign is... What was the sign for God's covenant with Abraham? Does anyone know? Not the most pleasant one. Circumcision. Yeah? Okay. Moving on. Any other covenants? There was a covenant with Moses. And the covenant sign was the Sabbath, actually. It came to Moses. And there's one more big covenant. Ten Commandments, part of the covenant with Moses. Yeah? Communion, baptism, the new covenant. Yeah, the new covenant. So your main covenants, really, we're going to come to them in a moment. But you've got a covenant with Noah. You've got a covenant with Adam, actually. You've got a covenant with Noah. You've got a covenant with Abraham. You've got a covenant with Moses. And then you've got the new covenant. There are some other sort of smaller covenants as well. Covenants meaning promises. What was God's threefold promise to Abraham? What have we got in those spaces there? Nation, yeah. Land. I'll make you to a nation and give you a land. A blessing. Yeah, to all the peoples on the earth. One more question. Why do we need to know God's big story? So it's great looking at us. It's great taxing our brains what the Bible's about. But why do we need to know the story of the Bible? That's quite an important question, isn't it? Well, we need to know because, as Judy said earlier, we need to know the rescue, don't we? We absolutely need to know the rescue through Jesus. We need to know who God is. We need to know who we are. We need to know where we come from. We need to know what our purpose is. And we need to know what the problem is. We need to know who Jesus is. We need to know what God has done, what God is doing, and we need to know what God will do as well, don't we? We need the Bible for all these big questions. But we're not just doing a Bible overview for these few weeks just so we know God's word, but so we kind of know of it, if you like, but we know God himself. That's the purpose. Through this, the aim is we know God himself, we see Jesus, and we respond in our hearts. And so we live well, we live better, we live by faith as the image bearers we are called to be. Do we know our purpose? Like everyone in this room, do you know your purpose? Do you know why you're on this planet? Our purpose is far greater than serving ourselves. It's far greater than fame or holidays. It's far greater than the next TV show on our comfy sofas. The plan is right here. The plan for all, each and every one of us is here. And it tells us in God's word, because the Bible is God-breathed. God-breathed, useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness. Do we believe that about the Bible? All of that. But we don't just need to know the Bible for ourselves, the law for ourselves. We need to know God's rescue through Jesus for the sake of the many around us, don't we? Who are desperately in need of knowing him. And that's what we're thinking about as a church, isn't it? Not only coming in here, and getting built up, but going out and spreading the word, seeing God's word going out. That's our purpose as a church. Where are we up to so far? Well, so far we have seen the pattern of God's kingdom. That's what we looked at week one. God's perfect plan for humans to live as his people. And we had these little two things here, which is God's pattern, is God's people in God's place under his rule. A little picture to help us there from Two Ways to Live. And of course, if you're recognizing this, this is Vaughan Roberts' God's Big Picture. If you're reading the book, let me encourage you, keep going. If you haven't got a copy, come and see me. Okay, but do read God's Big Picture. This is basically roughly it, what we're doing in these few weeks. And basically, this is paradise, God's pattern for his people. This is what it is to truly live as humans. No sickness, no evil, no pain, no heartache. And God made us to be his image bearers. He made us to rule over his creation, this world, under his authority, with his loving rule, in relationship with him and perfectly in relationship with each other, and to enjoy the rest. He rested on day seven, and the purpose of us to enjoy that in perfect relationship with God and one another. But God's good kingdom, his great kingdom, became kingdom lost. Instead of reigning over his creation, we set ourselves up as rivals, didn't we? Instead of kind of reflecting God's glory, actually we became rebels, gods unto ourselves. And the moment we turned from God and the beauty of his design for us, in that moment we began to perish. And that's what we saw week two, the perish kingdom. And sin is a tiny little word, but it speaks of huge problems. And the last verse in Genesis 3, and Genesis, the beginning of Genesis is where we're going to be, if you'd like to turn to it. The last verse in Genesis chapter 3 is just terrible. And it's basically verse 24. God drove them out of the garden. The great God, creator, loving creator, is angry at sin. And he's livid with it. He's not angry in a kind of spiteful or petty sense that we often get angry, but he is justly angry because his image bearers have become traitors. And that last verse in Genesis 3 is just horrible. I mean, to be driven out by God is an awful image. And the absurdity of it as well, we saw last time in Jeremiah 2, when God says kind of to the heavens, he says, be appalled at this, you heavens, shudder with great horror, for my people have turned from the spring of living water, me, this wonderful spring of living water, and they've gone over here and they've built their own cisterns and wells, broken ones. So there's God here, Jeremiah says, this spring of pure, perfect water bubbling up. But we said, hang on a minute, we've got a better idea. We'll go over here, we'll dig our own wells, broken ones that don't even hold the dirty water that we put in them. And God kind of calls the angelic beings to say, look what they're doing down there. What are they doing? They're leaving me, the source of living water, the spring of living water, for that. They are out of their minds to turn their backs on the source of all life, a broken, painful existence. It's madness. And it is. And that's what we live in today. That's the perished kingdom we live. And that's why sin just pervades everything, doesn't it? And it's in us. And it wrecks and ruins, doesn't it? And we feel it. And the perished kingdom looks like the God who made us being unwanted by people, who just kind of put their fingers in their ears, just ignore him and shut him out, refusing to listen. Instead, they turn to all sorts of things, like making idols out of everything else. And we say today, many say, well, we've moved on from God. We're so good. We've moved on. And yeah, in technology and what we know, we are getting advanced. That kind of makes us more dangerous, really. Because it's a heart thing, isn't it? Have our hearts changed? Have our attitudes to God changed and to each other? Well, the news and the Bible tells us no. Actually, things are getting worse. Paul says, evil men will go from bad to worse. There will be terrible times in the last days. Next week, we're going to remember 100 years since the end of World War I. But we can hardly celebrate a peaceful last 100 years, can we? It's been the bloodiest century in history from by a mile, hasn't it? The effects of Adam and Eve's sin was immediate. Shame and hiding was followed by arguing as their beautiful union was shattered. I mean, delight in each other. Remember when he first saw Eve? That delight has turned to disdain. She vies for his position and he blames her and all the rest of it. And before they know it, they're standing as a couple at a graveside, experiencing the heart-wrenching pain of death, the death of their own child killed by their other child. It's absolutely tragic, isn't it? If we read Genesis 1 to 6 right, we should feel aghast at how something so beautiful and wonderful can just be changed in a moment, and we should be left asking, is that it? Is that the end of the story? Will our relationship with God ever be restored? Can we ever get back to Eden? Or is Cain and Babel and death ours now and forever? Well, of course, there are a fair few pages after Genesis 6, aren't there? Great. And there are some people actually within the first 6 chapters of Genesis that should make us sit up. So Genesis 5:24, Enoch walked faithfully with God. Then he was no more because God took him away. I should get a scratch in our heads a little bit. And then chapter 6, verse 9. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. I mean, should think, how is that? How is that possible? Like, were these guys special in some kind of way? Is there something about them? Is God just kind of turning a blind eye to these sinners? Is he letting some people off? Why did Enoch and Noah, why are they enjoying the privileges and the blessings that only kind of sinless Adam enjoyed? Because the great news is that God does promise to restore the relationship. And that's where we're up to today, the promised kingdom. Now, promises are really significant for us on this earth, aren't they? We know the feeling when someone makes a promise and they keep it. It's great. We appreciate it. It's important. When we were children, at times we wanted others to know that we'd keep our word, didn't we? I've got a little secret to tell you. Children love doing that, little keeping their secrets. I'll tell you if you promise not to tell anyone else. Okay, why not? I've got some sweets. And all the rest of it. But then, of course, as adults, it gets more important, doesn't it? Promises become huge. I promise to stick by you for better or worse. I must admit, with more than half of my own children present, I'm probably very frustrating when it comes to promises. Because Nick and I find that with life being so fluid at times, instead of kind of making confident promises, we find ourselves saying, I'm going to try to do this. Hopefully we will. That's the plan, that kind of thing. But we don't always want to promise because we know, don't we? We all know what it's like to have someone make a promise but not keep it. Promises can be life-giving or they can be kind of life-stealing, if you like. Now, in the Bible, promises are mostly called covenants. And covenant is a word, really, for just a really strong promise. A promise with teeth, if you like. And Enoch and Noah had a relationship with God because they believed God's promises. So where is the first promise? Where's the first covenant in the Bible? Where's the first time God promises to restore the broken world? Well, it happens actually before the fall happens. There's the unseen covenant of salvation made within the Trinity before time began, before this world was made. Ephesians 1 tells us we are chosen before the creation of the world, predestined for adoption. Big verses, aren't they? Big truths. Predestination kind of sounds like a big word sometimes. It's really simple. Just think of buses. Every bus we get on, so you get a bus into Ipswich, has been predestined. A destination has been put on it before it's sent out of the yard. Where do you keep a bus? Sorry? Depot. Thanks. Predestination. Chosen before. So there's the covenant. Before the world was even made. But where's the first seen or heard covenant in the Bible? Well, it's in the garden before the fall, and it's called the covenant of works, because God promised Adam, if they obey, all is okay, kind of thing. Resist sin, stay in, if you want to remember it. That didn't last long at all, did it? Where's the next promise? It comes in the garden as well. This time just after the fall, when God says to the serpent, there's an offspring of Eve coming to crush your head. What kind of promise is this? Well, that's not a promise based on works. That is a declaration of good news, of grace. Kind of, you guys here, you messed up, but there is someone coming to fix the problem of evil. And so the gospel began in the garden. That is where the good news began, that evil will be defeated and Eden restored. And it's all of God. So all people had to do, all people could do, is actually believe God and trustingly wait for the one. And that is what Enoch and Noah did. In their oral culture, Adam would have passed down this promise. And if you want to do the maths of the genealogy of chapter 5, you can see chapter 5 is a load of names in Genesis. It says, from Adam to Noah, as a little subtitle. If you want to do the genealogy of chapter 5, you can work out, and I'd rather you do this later, please, that Enoch, seventh from Adam, would have known Adam. With Adam lived 930 years. And Adam would have known Noah's dad as well. They both believed this good news that they would have heard had been passed to them. So their sin and condemnation was replaced by righteousness because they believed. They trusted God's word. But not because of them. There's nothing from them. If you look again at chapter 6, verse 8, Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And then it's verse 9, Noah was a righteous man. It's all grace, it's all of God, isn't it? And for Enoch, in Hebrews 11, read to us earlier, it was by faith Enoch was able to please God. And what is faith? Faith is a gift from God as well. Now the reason we feel like such failures as Christians is because we are. We're honest. But it's often because we still live as if we're in the Adam covenant, in the covenant of works. We often mentally live in that place. That's why we find ourselves trying to do our best often to please God and then feeling rubbish with our puny efforts. See, where Enoch and Noah looked mattered. That was huge. We look into ourselves, we should get depressed. I look into myself, I know I can't be the Christian I want to be. I can't defeat sin. I don't love people as I ought. I won't pray for them. I won't want people to know about Jesus. That's us. That's what we're like. We don't find answers in us. We just find rebellion and we find ruin. But Enoch and Noah looked to God and they looked ahead to the new covenant. That's where they're looking, which ironically is older than the old covenant. They look to God's grace and kindness, God's promise to restore through the seed of Adam. They believe God's word, and so did another man of faith, Abram. And the promise of Genesis 3:15 must have been clung to by God's people over those few hundred years. But then come to Genesis 12, if you will, and God declares another promise about the seed. And some promises are bigger than others, but none are bigger than Genesis 12, 1-3. And these words are massive because this promise here, this section of the Bible frames the rest of the Bible, really. all that comes after this is an outworking of this covenant with Abraham. And as I read this promise from God, look out for the pattern of God's kingdom, the people, place, rule and blessing stuff. Genesis 12, 1 to 3. The Lord had said to Abram, go from your country, your people and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who curse you. And whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. God calls Abram, one who is no different from all the other rebels on the earth. And who would choose an old man with an elderly wife and no children to launch the restoration of Eden? But God always chooses people like that, doesn't he? They're the people he chooses in his word. And we see the pattern as that was read. To the backdrop of a rebellion, a sin and judgment, God says, Abram, I'm going to make your family into a great nation, into my own people. And I'm going to put them in their place, a people under my rule. I'm going to give them a land, Canaan, and I'm going to bless you. And through you, all the peoples on the earth will be blessed. This stretches far. Stretches further than Israel, doesn't it? And verse 4, what does it say? Abram bursts out laughing. You must be joking. That's not what it says. Verse 4, Abram went. And Hebrews 11, verse 8 says, you see that? You see what Abram did? That's faith. He obeyed, even though he didn't even know where he's going. It said in the Hebrews passage. Why? Because verse 10 in Hebrews, he was looking ahead. He was looking, verse 16, longing for a better country, a heavenly one. At times, Abram needed reassurance. So chapter 15 of Genesis, he's like, oh, really, God, is this really going to happen? And God says, yep, go outside, look at the stars, count them if you can. That's your family. Mind-blowing, isn't it? But still, as Abraham waits, he says, Lord, how do I know? And he waited a long time, didn't he? What if we mess up again? Great promise, but what if we mess it up? And the promise just gets better, because in Genesis 15, God sets up this really strange ceremony with Abram. It wasn't strange back then, because if two wanted to make a binding covenant, what they do is cut some animals in half. Yes, but gross, isn't it? It'd be amazing if we did this today, this kind of covenant. It might help us a bit with keeping our word. But they cut some animals in half and they made this isle of blood between the two halves of the animals. And then the two people would walk through down that aisle together, saying to each other, if I don't keep my word to you, then let death be upon me. What's happened to these animals happened to me. Pretty powerful, wasn't it? But what is strange and wonderful is then what happened after this has been set up in Genesis 15. Because after setting up this ritual, God put Abram into a deep sleep. And verse 17, God walked the aisle of blood alone. It's that smoking pot and brazier. And God is saying, I will keep my word. I alone will keep this promise, because when you don't keep your side, you won't, because you can't, I alone will suffer the consequences of broken promises. And isn't that amazing? God is saying, I will make you my people. I will give you a place to live. I will bless you. And when you're unfaithful, guess what's going to happen then? I'm going to pay the consequences. God underwrites his own promise of the gospel. I remember how Nicola's dad kindly acted as the guarantor of our first mortgage. So if I stuffed up my job and couldn't pay the house, he had it covered. Really kind of him. No pressure. But God in his grace says, I promise to restore the relationship. And when you mess up, I'll pay. And we think and we know Jesus, don't we? And this ought to have us reeling in wonder. In praise. I mean, we swapped God for broken wells. But God says, I'll fix it. I promise. And he's not only the covenant maker, he is the covenant keeper. And it happened as God promised. Abram, which means exalted father, became Abraham, father of a multitude. And so began the people of Israel, the partial kingdom. Don't worry, we're not going to start on this now, just very quickly. And where do we first see Israel as a multitude, as this great nation? Well, it's in Egypt, isn't it? And especially as they come out of Egypt, there's about 2 million of them. That's where we first see them as a nation. And where's the place? Of course, they go out of Egypt to Canaan. That's the land of the partial kingdom. And Moses and Joshua lead them there, don't they? And God's rule and blessing comes to them. How does that come to them in the partial kingdom? Well, it comes through the law, Ten Commandments said earlier. It comes through the king, the kings of the land. And the high points, if you like, of blessing for Israel were when David was on the throne. Before his great sin, they were good times for Israel. But it's a partial kingdom. We'll pick up on this next time. This partial kingdom of Israel is not the final plan. It can't be, because their sin wasn't dealt with, was it? Provision was made through the priests and the temple. Wonderful. But they had to keep offering sacrifices day after day, didn't they? None could crush the snake. That offspring hadn't appeared. And the law was great, and the law is good, but it condemns us, and it condemned the people. But they were to look, and to trust God's promise. All the promises, all the pointers to the serpent crusher to come. And it's so amazing that by the first kind of 15 chapters of Genesis, in these first 15 chapters, the gospel is so clear. In this first bit of the Bible, and there's so much more to come. It's a lot to take in. I've whizzed through this morning. If you've not understood some things said, do come and ask. I'd love to speak to you, and do talk to each other as well. Tea and coffee in a moment. Do talk to each other. What did he say about that? What's that about? You know, all these, I've rushed through a lot of things there, but do speak to each other and come and speak to me.